to but Iha in this life Vai or Shva of dogs Gardava and asses but they are maintainers Brahmana Agoyaha Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas. Rigiha, Vihara, taking pleasure in hunting animals in the forest. Atirte, other than prescribed. Cha, also. Rigan, animals. Nignanti, kill. Tan, then. Api, indeed. Samparehitan, having died. Lakshabhutan,
becoming the targets.
Yamapurushaha, the assistance of Yamaraj. Ishubihi, by arrows, vidyante, pierce. Translation, if in this life a man of the higher classes, Brahman, Kshatriya, and Vaishya, is very fond of taking his pet dogs, mules, or asses, into the forest to hunt and kill animals unnecessarily, he is placed after death into the hell known as Pranarudha. There the assistants of Yamaraj make him their targets and pierce him with arrows. Shoot. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada. In the Western countries especially, aristocrats keep dogs and horses to hunt animals in the forest. Whether in the West or in the East, aristocratic men in the Kali Yuga adopt the fashion of going to the forest and unnecessarily killing animals. Men of the higher classes, the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, should cultivate knowledge of Brahman, and they should also give the Shudras a chance to become to that platform. If instead they indulge in hunting, they are punished as described in this verse. Not only are they pierced with arrows by the agents of Yamaraj, but they are also put into the ocean of pus, urine, and stool described in the previous verse. It's very positive. So, Omagana Timurandasha Ganan Janau Shlakaya Chakshur Miditam Gena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, of course, in the Western world, also people love dogs, so-called love dogs, and keep dogs as pets, and they also keep cats as pets. And those are the two animals generally that are the most common as pets. I mean, there's other people, you know, some people have a pet tarantula or pet piranha, yeah. Or, you know, they have different, or pet snake, or pet this or pet that. But generally it's dogs and cats, but there's a common denominator in all the different types of pets that people keep. And that common denominator is that those pets please their senses in a particular way. Of course, according to the modes of nature, some people are attracted to different types of pets, right? Like one person will say, I'm a cat woman. And we're not talking about one of Gopal's favorite personalities. Or I'm a dog man, you know. Of course, we understand that if one is very attached to these animals and thinking of them at the time of death, that's what they'll become. Not a dog man, but a dog. Or a cat. Or a cockroach, or whatever they're attached to. But according to the modes of nature that one is subjected to, because of the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance, one seeks out a particular type of pet. I'm not going to say, you know, give a whole definition. Those in the mode of goodness will keep cows. Yeah, I guess I should go through it. And those in the mode of passion, they keep cats and dogs. And those in the mode of ignorance, they keep things like tarantulas and scorpions and other animals like that, you know, because they like to see violence. But in any case, it's all just sense gratification. It's all just, the animal is not being loved. The reason I'm saying that is because one is simply interested in pleasing their own senses, not pleasing the animal. And if they were interested in pleasing the animal, they wouldn't consider how much pleasing the animal is to them or not pleasing the animal is to them. In other words, they would see equally all living entities, yastu sarvani bhutani atmane bana pashati, sarvabhuteshu chatmanam tatodna vigyupshati. They would see all living entities equally, and they wouldn't hunt some animals and protect other animals. And so we see in America, they protect the dogs and cats like anything. I mean, there's the ASPCA, the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I mean, each country has their, you know, PS, yeah, not AS, you know, Australia would, of course, have the ASPCA, the NSPCA in New Zealand, and in Europe, the EUPSA or something like that. So, and then as far as the other animals, like the cows and the pigs, of course, nowadays people keep pigs as pets. The Vietnamese, you know, miniature pigs. So you see people walking around in New York, you know, with a pig on a leash. Which is kind of funny, you know. Is it? Well, it's just as gross to take a dog around. You know, but we see how much conditioned we are. She thinks it's gross to take a pig around, but a dog is kind of cute. Or a cat is kind of cute. But they're both just as gross. I mean, you say, oh, pig is gross because it'll eat any damn thing, but then I have the example of the dogs. When I was living in the forest, in the cabin, we didn't have any, let's say, formal bathroom. It was a, you know, the traditional bathroom. traditional, you know, hold the ground. You know, I just have to be honest about it. And so then I was noticing that it was clean, you know, and I didn't engage any disciples coming down and cleaning the informal bathroom. So I noticed every day someone was coming and cleaning up. And of course, we could say that's similar to the story of Lokanath Goswami and Narottama Das Thakur. You know that story? Narottama Das Thakur was wanting to take initiation from Lokanath Goswami, so every day he snuck around and cleansed the latrine of Lokanath Goswami. So I had someone who was cleansing every day, but it wasn't someone who wanted to take initiation. It was a dog. You know, the dog was cleansing with his mouth. He didn't take a broom or shovel or anything like that. So you may think, I mean, not to gross everyone out in class, but yeah, anyway, so the reason we're attracted to let's say dogs, for example, because they're very obsequious. And we want, obsequious is a fancy word in English. That means they always try to please you. And the reason they try to please you is not that they love you and they have some pictures of you in their little dog shed. Like a man and his wife, you know, the man has pictures of his wife at work, and the woman has pictures of her husband in a little locket around the neck. So we don't give dogs little lockets with pictures of their master. So the reason they try to please you is because of their own interests. The dog is not thinking the same thing you are when you're petting him. You're thinking, oh, love, 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 and the dog's not thinking love, love, love. The dog is thinking it feels good to be scratched. So there's no real exchange of what Prabhupada termed rasas. Rasa means an exchange of mellows. Rasa means mellows or mellows. Let's see, let's describe the word mellow. Mellow means like taste in a relationship. Like a rasa of different food would be a particular taste of salty or sugar, sweetness or something like that. So the rasa in a relationship is exchanged between different entities if they're experiencing basically the same rasa. Otherwise, it's not an exchange of rasas. In other words, they have to be of the same species, Prabhupada said. So you don't really have love in a material platform or on a material platform that's between living entities of different species. It's not. You have love in the spiritual platform between living entities and different types of bodies or different species of bodies. That can be because you love the soul. Let's say you have a dog and you're trying to help the dog become Krishna conscious and bringing the dog to Mangalarti and teaching it how to do RT and everything like that. Not really, I'm just being a little facetious. But let's say you're chanting, you see a cockroach, you start chanting to the cockroach, you start chanting to the ant, and you start chanting to the dog. Then you can have some real love for these living entities. But otherwise, it's just, you know, I get pleased by what you're doing or my interactions with you, and you get pleased by your interactions with me. In other words, I scratch your back, and you scratch my back. It's a business exchange. So there's no real love or exchange of rasas between entities in the different bodies. It's all just exploitation. So here we find described in this particular verse someone who's going out and hunting. And in America, of course, this hunting is considered something very common and very desirable. Even we have politicians who put videos of themselves hunting. And even nowadays, women put videos of themselves hunting. There was one governor of a particular state, ex-governor of a particular state, and she had videos of herself in a helicopter with a high-powered gun, you know, hunting down reindeer or deer or something like that. And, you know, everyone thought, oh, this is so wonderful. She's killing all these animals in a very sporting way. Of course, a sporting way, if you really want to have a sporting way, then you would have the animals also would have an opportunity to kill you. Now, of course, you couldn't give animals guns to shoot you with. They wouldn't know how to use them. But it would be sort of like an equal type of opportunity. That's a sport. I mean, just like one of these sports they have nowadays are paintball. You've heard of paintball? Where people go and they shoot little paintballs at each other. There's two teams. Each team has an equal opportunity to hit each other, because they don't kill each other. That's sporting. Or, you know, football or basketball. Any of these things are sporting because you have different teams. But with the animals, there's no different teams. You know, 10 points for the deer. You know, 2 points for the man. So it's not really sporting. It's cruelty. And anyone who takes joy in other living entities suffering will actually have to understand that suffering by experiencing that suffering himself when he goes to Yamraj. That's the point. It's called restorative justice. I was just thinking this morning about how people make animals suffer. I was thinking of one animal in particular. I was thinking of the lobster. You know, generally people think, you know, the lobster is just like, you know, a machine or something like that. I don't know what they think. But they take this poor lobster, if you go into some seafood store, and they take the lobster and just put him into boiling water, just immediately drop him into boiling water. And you could imagine that. I was just thinking, like, it's so intense, the pain that living entity must be experiencing. Because it's a fact that the nervous system, or the ability to experience pain is just as developed in a crustacean, whether it's a lobster, who has an exoskeleton, and a fish, as it is in a human being. I mean, yes, the higher reasoning power is not there. I understand that. I mean, you've never seen a lobster go to Bhagavatam class or speak philosophy. That's true. But the ability to experience pain is there in the same way in a lobster. So just thinking how cruel that is. So if people can't understand that explanation, then there's this thing called restorative justice. which is a very interesting discussion of justice, because here we're talking about the Yamadutas punishing living entities. There's two types of justice. One is called retributive justice, and the other one is called restorative justice. Then anyone who studied justice in university will know what I'm talking about. Retributive justice means that if someone does something wrong, let's say they kill someone, then retributive means we want to get even with him. You understand? Get even, make him suffer. It makes us feel good to see someone suffer. And we've had that happen to ourselves, isn't it? I mean, someone does something to us and causes us to suffer in one way or the other. I mean, just like, was it? Sometimes I'm driving with a particular individual. I'm not driving. Someone else is driving. And someone cuts them off and they just, you know, even though it's not going to save their life or, you know, the incident is over, they just push their horn down for 5 minutes just to make them suffer. Yeah. Of course, in India, you got to have a horn on 24 hours a day. Even when the car is stopped, but you leave your horn on because, that's a practical thing. Just like there's that story that one time the devotees were in a car, and the horn didn't work. And they asked Prabhupada what they should do, and then Prabhupada took out one of these steel plates and started banging on it. You know, because obviously in India, you've got to blow your horn. It's not justice, retributive or restorative justice. However, anyway, so sometimes people just blow the horn, just show him. And you make someone suffer, you suffer or not. Or, like in that, I've experienced that a lot of times with someone who remained nameless. So, or people just, do this tailgating outside of a prison house where someone is supposed to be killed, capital punishment because they did something, and there's a whole bunch of people like waiting for news that this person has been killed, and they just go joy, you know, after they heard the person is being killed. That's retributive justice. You just get joy out of getting even with someone. Of course, that's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth type of thing. So that's not what the Yamadutas are doing. Of course, they may be happy in their service. It's not that I would want that particular job. But in any case, that's not really what they're doing. They're doing something called restorative justice. Restorative justice means that if someone doesn't understand the pain they're causing to someone else, then they should experience it so they understand what they've done. That's all. Not just a punishment for the sake of punishment is useless. I mean, it just makes someone more defiant. And, you know, I experienced that when I was young, when my mother would punish me, and it really didn't fit the crime. Of course, I was a criminal. In the eyes of my mother, in many ways. Not in the eyes of the law. But it just didn't fit the crime. It was just like, yeah, I'm gonna spank you because you didn't eat everything on your plate. And what, did that make me want to eat everything on my plate? It made me want to just run away, when she wasn't looking, throw the food somewhere else. You know, it just made me defiant. So we have to understand that punishment for the sake of punishment makes people defiant. And we see that in the American judicial system. It makes people more defiant. And of course, when they go to prison, the prison is sort of a very comfortable situation for them, so that there's no negative aspect to it practically. Except, and after a while, in America, we were talking to some people about this, that when they go to prison, they have this on their record, and they can't get a job after that. So they've gone to prison, can't get a job, so the only way they can maintain themselves is going back to prison. So the judicial system in America is really, really bad. So, but restorative justice means to basically help someone understand the pain that they caused others. And There are ways to do that even without going to the Yamadutas. In the American judicial system, they're attempting different methods of restorative justice. And one of those methods is that you come face to face with the person that you've hurt. And the person that you've hurt gets a chance to express how they feel, what they felt, and what it did to them. And then you're put in front of them for such a period of time that after a while you get it. You have to reflect what they said or how they feel in an empathic way. In other words, you have to learn empathy. So this is called restorative justice. This is what the Yamadutas do. So if someone doesn't have empathy, if someone won't learn like that, then they have to experience the same pain themselves. So empathy is actually extremely important. And that's why it says here that a man in the higher classes, Brahman, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, they're supposed to have empathy. Someone in the mode of ignorance is like a psychopath. And psychopath doesn't mean someone who just like runs around, you know, and does crazy things. A psychopath may be a sociopath also. That means someone who has no feelings for others. They're just like completely selfish. That's a mode of ignorance. And there are people like that. There was this one book that I mentioned the other day. The name of it is either No Conscience or whatever. Anyway, and it's about people who are like that, who have actually no empathy or feeling for others. And there's practically no way to socialize them except you just lock them up. And that psychopath, that's what a psychopath is. Not simply an axe murderer, you know, but someone who's just exploitative or exploits others. Someone who's extremely selfish. So the Krishna consciousness movement is meant for not developing psychopaths. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant for developing people who are empathic. Not people who are simply interested in criticizing others. That's another problem with religion. Religion sometimes develops psychopaths. What do I mean? Because people are given knowledge that is supposedly absolute knowledge. And as they say, you know, absolute power corrupts, so absolute knowledge can also corrupt one. And when you have absolute knowledge, you tend to criticize others. And you tend to take a position, you know, I'm better than others, and then you lose your compassion. That's why there have been studies of religious societies, and in those studies it was ascertained that people who are members of religious societies, 80% of the people who are members of religious societies have less compassion or empathy than people in general, which is quite interesting. 80%. Of course, there's 20% who have more compassion and more empathy than people in general. And that 20% has actually gotten the essence of the religion. And the essence, rather than just the rituals or the details or the philosophy of the religion, there's an essential aspect of religion. So many times we become caught up in the externals, or even the philosophical aspects of Krishna consciousness, which are good and true. You know, obviously I believe in Krishna consciousness. I really do. But sometimes we actually just become so caught up that you don't see the forest for the trees. You don't see the essence of Krishna consciousness. The essence is described of course, in the Bible. To love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and all thy might. That's the essence of Krishna consciousness. Yes, it's true we reincarnate. Yes, it's true the Yamadutas are going to get you if you don't behave. Yes, it's true that, you know, if you do this, you get that reaction, etc. I mean, there's all these different details that are true. And there's certain things that are just relative too. It's not true that you have to wear a dhoti to go back to Godhead, especially if you're a woman. So that's not true. It's not true that you have to shave your head in a certain way to go back to God. It's not true that you have to, go to the bathroom in a certain way to go back to God. I mean, people get into these rituals. Like, in other words, to go back to God, you have to stand on a toilet instead of sitting on a toilet. I mean, they get it so much into these things. But these are just relative truths. But even with the absolute truths, we have to understand what it means to integrate those absolute truths into one's being. And that's a very simple thing. You have to love God, like the gopis, for example. They weren't great philosophers. They simply loved Krishna so much that everything else, their own sense gratification or own happiness, was inconsequential. And that's religion in a nutshell. The gopis are the best example of that. That you just try to satisfy God and love God, and then at that point, then you develop compassion for everybody else, because everybody else is connected with God. Yastu sarvani bhutani yatmane vanapashati. So, this is a verse from the Upanishad. One who sees everybody connected with God doesn't hate anyone or hate anything or criticize unnecessarily. You know, go on the internet and criticize people. I mean, really just feel compassion and love for all living entities. So this is, as Prabhupada said, referring to Saint Francis of Assisi, because we all know Saint Francis of Assisi, or some of you may know of him. He was the saint who considered all living entities as his brother and sister. And so Prabhupada said that is first-class God consciousness. So that's a symptom. That's a symptom of God consciousness right there. Not how much philosophy one has, how many degrees one has, like Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Bhai Baba. Of course, that may be good in helping one preach. Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vedanta degree. But how much compassion you have for others. Look, the topmost Vaishnava in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, and one of the topmost was Vasudev Dat. And Vasudev Dat's quality was Paraduga Duki, which means, one who considers others' happiness more than one's own happiness. So that's religion in a nutshell. So here the Yamadutas are trying to make people understand that other living entities have feelings. As they say, But somehow other people just don't get it. I mean, it's something I just can't even understand why people don't get it. Because they're in the mode of ignorance. We have to raise them at least to the mode of passion, and ultimately to the mode of goodness and transcendental goodness, so they'll understand these things. Otherwise, there's no hope for society. There's no hope. I mean, if people are just like so selfish. I mean, really, that's what meat eating means. It's the epitome of selfishness, isn't it? It's the epitome of selfishness because you're torturing another living entity to satisfy yourself. So, on that happy note, any questions or comments? Yeah.
Out of curiosity, a few verses back, specific animals are people that were hurt by others.
Yes.
I'm wondering every animal. About the job description for the Yamadutas. How do you qualify? Who are they in relation to the...
I'll give you an application later.
The simple man becomes the target of these hunters in the form of Yamaraj. So are they the previous animals?
Yamadutas are not the previous animals. The Yamadutas... it's not really described how one applies for that position or what are the qualities that one has. But it appears that the Yamadutas are not pure devotees of the Lord like Yamaraj because they do make mistakes, like in the case of Ajamil. They actually arrested Ajamil even though he was chanting the holy names. So it appears that there somehow are there people who want to have that service. And it's a service for Krishna, and they're engaged in associating with Yamaraj, too, who is a Mahajan. He's a great pure devotee. So somehow or other, They're serving the pure devotee and their influence. Obviously, they have some influence by the mode of ignorance, but they still have some faith in the pure devotee, Yamaraj, and they're following his directions. So exactly what one has to do in this life to get that position of a Yamaduta in the next life, I don't know.
And they're residing in hell. It's part of their karma, but it's also...
Yeah, but they're not the ones who are being tortured. They're the ones who are tortured. So somehow or other, Yamaraj is engaging, just like Lord Shiva engages ghosts and witches and, you know, spirits and all those other nice entities. And therefore Lord Shiva is considered very compassionate. So in the same way, Yamaraj is considered very compassionate because he's engaging them in a necessary service. It's a service for Krishna. I mean, what can I say? It's a service for Krishna to rectify. I mean, just like people in the government, some people have to work in the prison house, just like our Krishna Nama. He was in charge of so many different prisons around the United States. And so, of course, he wasn't engaged in the stuff we're reading about. I doubt it. You know, he's a very compassionate person. But still, you know, he had to take that service. So someone has to work in the prison house. And so somehow or other, they had that nature that they wanted to do that. And Krishna was engaged. And they're also devotees. There's no doubt about it. The Yamadutas are devotees because they have that nature of wanting to serve Yamaraj. They're following the orders of Yamaraj and they're associating with Yamaraj. Anyway, I'll have to ask them next time I see them. How did you get that job? Are there any openings? I have some candidates for you. So, any other questions? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the animal can reflect the mood. We're not talking against that. But it's just the animal is not exchanging the same sort of rasa that the human being is. Because it's just not on the same wavelength. You understand? It's just not. It's a different species. It can't exchange in the same way. Does that make sense? Even though it can reflect your moods. Yeah, certainly, even a plant can reflect your moods. I mean, they talk about people with having green thumbs. So if you have nice attitude towards your plants will grow better. And if you have angry, and even water reflects your mood. You know, the water crystals reflect your mood. I mean, everything's connected. I was just reading, like, how every cell in your body has a cellular memory. You know, remembers when you were a little baby. Every cell in the body, you know, and it's connected somehow or other. You know, this is, of course, a very subtle thing. Anyway, they did one experiment. I guess we have time for this. They had, they took some cells out of someone's mouth. And they put it in a different room. And then they subjected the person to stress. And then the cells in the other room actually experienced that same stress. So there's something happening on the cellular level. And even one time, there was another experiment. They took two people, introduced them to each other. Hello, I'm Mr. Jones, I'm Mr. Smith. And they talked for a little while. And they put them in separate rooms. And they shone a light into one person's eyes and to dilate the pupils and that thing. Same thing happened to the other person in the other room. So, I mean, there's different subtle things happening, too. What was that about? There's different subtle communication between living entities. There's subtle energies going on. And there's a lot going on in this creation that we're not aware of. I mean, you read about this stuff and it appears amazing. But there's so many things going on that we're not in contact with that are happening. I mean, the scientists are discovering them. Anyway, there's all sorts of theories, you know, quantum theories and everything like that. I'm not going to get into those details. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a question. So how is it that the punishment with changing a person's subtle body such they feel more compassion or that they won't perform that activity again?
Because if they experience, even if it's unconscious, because later on they're not going to remember it, obviously. But you learn lessons. I mean, like I always give this example. When I was young, I learned how to walk, obviously. I can walk now. But I don't remember how I learned how to walk. You know, there's a lesson that I learned. And, yeah, and there's certain things I don't like to eat, like beetroots. And I don't remember specifically, maybe I do, but anyway, I don't remember specifically my mother feeding me borscht. I mean, even that word, you can hear how I say it, borscht. So, but still, there's impressions on the subtle body. We have all these impressions, and this is also, it's interesting, it also makes its way into the gross body on the cellular level. And these things can cause diseases. So, when the body is put in stress, you have all these built-up stresses that accumulate, not only in this lifetime, but in previous lifetimes. And these can cause all sorts of aberrations, physiological aberrations. Problems, that is. So, we learn a lesson, even though I don't remember how, let's say in the past I was subjected to the Yamadutas. I don't know. I definitely don't remember. Sometimes people do remember these things, just like I have one of the sons of one of my disciples. He just went into a World War I museum and he started crying and I actually almost went unconscious into a coma because he remembered how he was a soldier in World War I. And I've been corresponding with him. He's a little boy, he's like 7 years old. And he's asking me questions. And I said, well, that means you're a soldier. And he said, I didn't want to hear that one. So, sometimes we do. But generally, you don't remember. So the point is we learned our lessons. So let's say in the past I had to see the Yamadutas. And they showed me what some other living entity was suffering from that I had made to suffer. And so I learned that. I mean, when I actually think of a lobster being thrown into the water, which is what I thought of this morning, hot water, boiling water, I actually feel like, somehow or other, I just feel a physiological response to that. It's not just like on a psychological level. I feel, I almost feel like the pain from it. So who knows? Maybe the Yamadutas did that to me in the past to teach me a lesson. I don't know, but somehow or other I respond in that way. Maybe just because I'm more connected and a little more Krishna conscious, I'm connected to the lobsters that I feel. But I actually feel like physical sensations when I think of that.
So compassion can also change the physical body.
Yeah. Yeah, you actually feel, if you're compassionate, you actually feel physical pain or whatever. I mean, maybe not to the same extent, obviously. I'm not, like that. But that's part of compassion.